Welcome to the Flow Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording. It's 1:30 p.m. the Pacific Summer Time. Today is June 12th, and today being Friday, it's the big picture, long-term audio and video for the various different asset classes. And I thought we'd kick off the week with the Dow Gold Ratio, because it has contracted really quite considerably over the course of the last 2.5 years. And that is a really big question mark over the integrity of the secular bull market, because historically, when we look over the course of the last century, then we haven't really seen significant breakdowns in the ratio over any period of a secular advance in stocks. And yet this has been a very significant breakdown in the ratio over the course of the last year and a half. So we have to ask big questions. The very significant bull market that began in let's just go back and look at the early 1980s, and then we had this very prolonged period of advance for the ratio. Now, there was a bit of a hiccup in 1987, so perhaps this is a corollary, that this is a similar move to what we had in 1987, and then subsequently stocks rebounded and kept going. If that is indeed the case, then we should see additional upside. But we've seen a very significant downdraft in here this week. And part of the reason for that was because of the large move that we saw on the Dow yesterday, where it fell 6.9%. And that's a significant event. Now, what is particularly interesting today is the argument about whether this is a buy the dip opportunity, or is it a peak of medium-term significance and potentially a lower high following the peak that we had earlier on in the year in February? Now, when we look at the consistency of the short-term trend up from March, then we can see that there have been reactions, and that these reactions have, by and large, been in the order of about 1,000 points. So that's certainly true. Now, the big move we had yesterday was a decline of 1,800 points, and that was following 2 other days on the downside. So this move on the downside has been, over the course of 4 days, been a decline of 2,000 points. So it is somewhat larger than the ones that we've seen. But the question now is whether that psychological 25,000 level is going to hold. Now, when we zoom out and look at this on a weekly basis, then we are, I think, given some additional information. I think the first should be that we had a reasonably consistent advance coming up to the peak in January, February of this year, and that in the course of this decade-long advance, in fact, it's more like 11 to 12 years, that during medium-term corrections, the index has found support in the region of the 1,000-day moving average, and it has now pushed back above that, and until yesterday had been above the 200-day moving average. So the most important thing that we can say for certain is that we had a failed upside break above the upper side of the 18-month range, and that breakdown not only came down to test the lower side of the range, but broke on the downside. That's a major trend inconsistency. It is a type 2 top formation characteristic. It's a massive reaction against the prevailing trend. That's certainly the big takeaway that we get from the medium-term trend. Then we have to take out our playbook and think about, well, what is it that generally accompanies a type 2 top? The massive reaction against the prevailing trend is surprising. That's the definition of the bolt from the blue. By the virtue of it being surprising, it means that people are not really cognizant of what the reason for the decline was. Now, on this occasion, it was because of the imposition of lockdowns and the fright that the market had taken at the coronavirus. So we do have a rationale for why we had this significant decline. And there is the clear, and I believe in many respects, accurate characterization of the decline as a natural disaster. However, it's not like a natural disaster like a hurricane, which is how most people have tended to look on it. Because after a hurricane, the first thing is that most of the time you know it's coming. The second is that they don't generally last for more than a few days. And once they have petered out, it's unlikely that the same area is going to be hit by another hurricane in such a short period of time that reconstruction can't occur. Reconstruction is a stimulative endeavor in its own right, and people are not overly inconvenienced because they've experienced these kinds of events before and they know how to deal with them. So in many respects, this is like a natural disaster. It's just that it is considerably worse than anything else we've had because it has eradicated 20 million jobs, and that's a conservative figure. It's perhaps much more like 25, 30, or 40 million jobs in the USA. 20% has been knocked off of the GDP of the UK, and that takes the size of the economy back to where it was in 1999. In fact, the very fact that the stock market has gone nowhere for the last 20 years is being in fact reflected now by the performance of the economy. So that there is certainly something to speak about there. But now the question is, what happens after the type 2 top? Creates indecision. I think that's after the surprise, then people start to look around and they go, well, golly, I've been waiting for a buying opportunity. This is a buying opportunity, so I'm going to buy. And then people rush back in. Then you have people, this is exactly when the emergency investment committee meeting gets called, and people are there are always going to be people who think it's a buying opportunity. There are also going to be people who think that it's the end of the world, so that they're going to advocate selling. When you put people like that on the same committee, then the logical conclusion is more than likely going to be, let's wait and see. So the wait and see means that there is going to be a reticence to commit capital. In other words, people stop buying. Well, stopping buying means that the focus of additional speculative interest is concentrated in the hands of a smaller number of investors. It is quite likely that it's at this stage where you get a strong momentum move that retail investors get sucked in. And that is exactly what has happened, particularly since February, where there has been a massive flood of investing. Now, there are a number of factors. One thing is the young guy at UPS, and I go to UPS quite regularly, was asking me for stock advice back in February. I saw an article today where the son of someone's dentist was asking them for, I think, trading advice. We've had this massive surge in the Twitter following for day traders, and that has been a very significant factor in speculative activity. But what we also know is that the quantity of, or the number of people that are committing additional funds to the market has narrowed. Now, one of the factors that I've seen parroted over the course of this week was that there was, as a result of people sitting on the sidelines, there is a large quantity of cash that could be devoted to a significant break on the upside. Now, that is potentially true, on the assumption that people are in fact willing to buy. But the problem with it is that we are still in a very uncertain environment, and companies are not giving guidance on what the potential earnings are likely to be. We have the Federal Reserve telling us that the US economy is not going to get back to where it was in January until the latter half of 2022. That pretty much takes out the potential for a V-shaped recovery. And the problem for the stock market is that it has priced in a V-shaped recovery. Now, I do think it is particularly relevant that for a medium-term investor to pay attention to the fact that we've had a very significant drop below the 1,000-day moving average. And generally speaking, when we look at previous peaks, then we can go back to the 2007 period and indeed back to 2001. When the 200-day moving average falls through the 1,000-day moving average, it is generally evidence of a downtrend. And I don't think it makes a lot of sense to talk about bull market, bear market, and 10% or 20% reactions. What we're really more concerned with as medium-term investors is whether we have just simple filter questions. Is it a big bull market or a bear market? And that is the big question that we have right now. It's why the Dow gold ratio is so important, because gold has been outperforming the stock market on average for most of the last 2 years. And it took another leg higher in here this week. That's a very significant factor, because in a secular bull market, we would anticipate that stocks beat just about everything, and that is at present no longer the case. Now, when we get the rebound from a type 2 bottom, after a type 2 top, you get the massive reaction against the prevailing trend, then it is quite likely you get a sharp rebound until the value element of the advance runs its course. Then there are even fewer people willing to pay up, and then you get a consolidation, and a range often forms. It is where that range forms and how it finds support at key levels is going to be the major determinant of whether it turns into a medium-term range with a view to markets pushing on the upside later, or it moves into a range that eventually rolls over into a completed type 2 top with right-hand extension. Or another way of thinking about it would be that it is a first step below the type 2 top. Now, when we look at the S&P 500, then it has got back up to test the peak, and it is back above its 200-day moving average, and it is finding support today in the region of 3,000, and 3,000 had been an important area of resistance all the way through 2018 and most of 2019. If the index can continue to hold in this 3,000 level, then that would be the best of all possible worlds. We would be in a rather benign stock market environment if it can not only have rebounded back above the 1,000-day, but rebounded through the 200-day and subsequently found support above it, then we would be in a really benign environment. Now, there is the potential that that could be the case. Now, one of the most important things right now is that it is relevant to think about big round numbers. The Dow Jones is pausing at 25,000. The S&P 500 is pausing at 3,000. The NASDAQ 100 is right there at about 6,500, having encountered resistance this week in the region of 10,000. And 10,000, five digits, is a very significant period of our position where people will reassess. You would really have to be brave to be the first person to buy at 10,000 the next time we look at it. It is, I think, quite likely that we are due at least consolidation. But the pause at 10,000 is a very significant factor. And it is something where people will reassess. They will decide whether it is worth paying up for these companies. I think it is also relevant to highlight that the FANG index has been holding this sequence of higher reaction lows since March, and that it has also steadied, and that when we look at the size of the reactions, they have been relatively similar sized, and this is another similar sized reaction. So it was looking likely that it would consolidate, and it is now pausing in the region of the previous peak. What we can see with all of these indices is that they are at really quite clear areas of potential support. We can look at the FTSE 100, where it had unwound most of its overextension relative to the trend mean and has come back to test the 6,000 level. But again, we can look at the short-term trend and see the consistency, that the ranges are more or less one above another, and that 6,000 is a potential area where this one should find support. The last one also dipped into the underlying range, but not by very much. So again, 6,000 is an important area of support there. And then when we look at the DAX index in Germany, well, we have support coming through potentially at 12,000 and the region of the 200-day moving average. And again, I think it is particularly relevant to pay attention to the fact that we have the 1,000-day and the 200-day moving average, and that historically they may come close together, but then the 200-day bounces. Now, with this significant downward dynamic that we've seen this week, there is the potential that it could find support, but there is also the potential that it's going to fail. And that is equally true for every one of the indices we've seen so far. Now, we have to, I think, start to think about where are we in terms of the overall cycle. And that's one of the most important questions. The Dow Jones, or the Dow Gold ratio, tells us that the medium term, or the secular bull market hypothesis, is now being significantly questioned. So that is one of the more important questions. Bigger point then is whether technology is capable of going it alone. And when we look at some of the biggest companies in the world, those that have got trillion-dollar market caps, then they've also had some of the more consistent chart patterns. Apple, in particular, has been able to demonstrate that it can hold support in the region of the 1,000-day moving average, and that when it does become overextended, it can move into these lengthy ranges. Now, we can see that in 2012-13, in 15-16, and again in 2018 through to 19. And it would have been logical that if the consistency of this broad trend was going to remain the case, it would have ranged for up to a year here. It has not done that. It has broken on the upside. This is a significant acceleration in the trend, and it tells us that the imbalance between supply and demand has changed. Now the question is whether it is going to succeed in holding on to this breakout. When we look at Microsoft, we can also clearly observe that there has already been acceleration. The pace of the advance has picked up considerably. The share price is up from 30 in 2013 to 180. So we've already had a very meaningful advance. And it got up to a new high this week and failed. Now the question is whether it is going to hold the current level. We are at a critical juncture, not just for stock markets, but also for individual stocks. This is exactly where some of these companies need to demonstrate that they can hold their breakouts. That's equally true of Amazon. It's an extraordinarily volatile share, but this is exactly the point where if it is going to continue to find support, this is the area. Now, what therefore could be the mitigating factor? The fact that we've had these downward dynamics, that we had overbought conditions, what is it that could help to suspend prices at elevated levels? Well, on the one hand, we have the fact that we've got central bank balance sheets which continue to expand, and the total assets of balance sheets are up to 24.6 trillion. But you will notice that this week it did contract. Now, the reason it contracted was because of the strength of the dollar. And we had a meaningful rebound yesterday and some follow-through in here today. At least some unwinding of the oversold condition is likely. Whenever the dollar strengthens, it reduces the value of the assets sitting on central banks internationally. So it's an inhibiting factor to global liquidity. That's quite apart from the willingness of other central banks, as well as the Federal Reserve, to increase their overall assistance. When the dollar strengthens, it's an inhibiting factor to global liquidity. That's part of the. It's both a cause and effect to the additional volatility that we've seen on stock markets. But the bigger picture is that the Federal Reserve is responsible for approximately half of all the monetary assistance being afforded to markets right now. We can also see that the really big moves were in March and April, and that the pace of assistance has moderated considerably since the beginning of May. But even in May, they added $500 billion. What was announced this week is that the pace of assistance is going to moderate significantly, and that it will amount to approximately $120 billion a month for the foreseeable future, and that interest rates are not going to rise in that time. Now, the Federal Reserve has been very clear in stating that they are not going to go for negative interest rates, and that's at least a positive for the stock market and also for the banking sector. On the other hand, the low interest rate environment is something that is going to put a significant squeeze on the profitability of banks generally. That throws additional impetus onto the central bank to provide assistance, and also onto governments. So if we're going to see a significant pop on the upside, if the stock markets are going to extend their advances, then we're going to have to see additional capital infusions and additional measures by governments to expand their deficits even more. But debt is already at an all-time high, and it is already in excess of what would be considered troublesome debt-to-GDP ratios in a host of countries. So the problem that governments and central banks have is that the medicine is potentially worse than the disease. It's almost exactly the same condition that governments have had when they've talked about lockdowns. Are the lockdowns themselves more damaging than the result of the coronavirus? I think that's one of the biggest questions. But some of the things that we've seen, when we think about the where are we in the overall bull market, we're certainly in the third psychological perception stage of the bull market. And let's just think about what that means. What do central banks do when they feel there's trouble? They print money. What do major bull markets require in order to inflate asset prices in whatever the asset that's about to have a bubble requires? Well, then they just they invest in it. When we look at what the reactions of investors had been to the aftermath of the credit crisis, it was to first to look at the massive amount of money that was being created, which incidentally has been dwarfed by the quantity of money that has been printed over the course of the last 3 months. They took that money and they invested it in speculative vehicles. The reason for that is that when you're a yield-hungry investor and you cannot get anything close to the return or the expected return that you require from conventional assets, then you go into more speculative assets. There is nothing more speculative than venture capital. The entire business model of venture capital is based upon making a large number of bets and more than half of them failing, but that the few that succeed at generating sufficient returns to more than compensate for the initial risk. Well, Uber has been one of those success stories for the early investors, not so much for the stock market investors. And the willingness to, or perhaps not willingness, the rush to enter the IPO market in early 2019 was in realization that we were late in the cycle. Lyft IPO'd very soon afterwards. Now, those were failed IPOs, and they are still trading significantly below where their IPO price was, and arguably they're both still trending down. So it was not a great deal for investors to invest in these companies. That's the other big thing, that it's venture capitalists and private equity firms. They generally get first pickings of bargains at the beginning of the cycle, and they are among the first to sell in the late stages of the cycle. And that's exactly what has happened. We've had major private equity firms exiting from these inflated unicorns, and unicorns today are becoming an endangered species. And those that did not succeed in IPOing, well, a substantial number may not be around 12 months from now. So that's one factor. Then we have the fact that retail investors have been active in markets for the last few years, but that was particularly the case in 2017. And Bitcoin surged on the upside. And it went from $1,100 to $20,000 in the space of about 9 months. It subsequently gave up about 90% of that advance, and it has been in a volatile range since. The fact that it has been so quiet over the course of the last few months is, I think, supportive of the view that those speculative traders who cut their teeth in trading Bitcoin are now doing something else. Well, they certainly had a good time buying Beyond Meat. And when we look at the IPO price, it rallied really quite spectacularly in the first 3 months of its existence. Then we move on a few months and we see that Virgin Galactic did fantastically well as well. Goes from about $10 to about $40. And then we had the very impressive move by Nikola, which is an electric truck company, in here this week. And it went from about $10 to $80. Well, $90 in fact. So it isn't as if we haven't had retail interest. There is certainly, though, a very significant conclusion to be drawn here. Retail investors have been heavily active in the markets for at least 3 years already. We're certainly starting to see that there are increasing news stories about Twitter and I can't remember the chap's name, but he has 1.5 million followers. He's been trolling Warren Buffett, and they are running on the mantra that stocks only go up. So one of the most important things to understand about markets is that the price setting mechanism happens at the margin. And when the vast majority of investing is through ETFs, then it doesn't require, or at least it requires, a comparatively small amount of capital all coming to the market at the same time to move markets. And that's exactly what we've been seeing. But the most important thing to pay attention to is the prices at which some of these shares trade, because the vast majority of day traders like stocks with small prices. It is difficult for a day trader to trade in Amazon when every share is $2,500. That cuts out a significant segment of the day trading market. Of course, then when we look at one of the primary vehicles they use, well, then you have to look at the options markets, and then you get back down to the relatively smaller prices. So that, I think, is one of the other important points, that retail investors either are buying individual shares with low prices, or they are speculating excessively in the options market. And those options then carry leverage, and they also move the market because of the volatility and price setting mechanisms that affect market making. The put call ratio and the number of calls and demand for calls is something that often affects how stocks are priced. So these are important considerations, that retail investors are not really a new phenomenon. Certainly the power they have on the wider market is a new phenomenon, but that this interest has been growing for at least 3 years. Then we have the fact that the number of companies that are now in the market which do not make money and are still attracting interest is really at an extraordinary level. And perhaps there is no better example than Hertz. The share is down significantly over the course of the last 6 months, going from $20 to 40 cents. And they announced over the last 2 days that they're going to issue $1 billion in new shares. And the stock has not collapsed. So this is an extraordinary circumstance, that a company that is on the cusp of bankruptcy is in fact well able to raise capital is a really quite incredible phenomenon. The fact that risk-taking is being extraordinarily rewarded by investors is something that we should be paying attention to, because we have the exact opposite condition with Grubhub. Grubhub is the only one of the food delivery companies that has ever turned a profit. And when we look at the company, it's valued at about 5.5 billion. But when we look at the funding rounds for companies like Postmates or DoorDash, then they approach that metric without ever having made a profit. And because Grubhub has been less aggressive on its growth strategy and has been more responsible and trying to make a profit, it's now been taken over by a company that's never made a profit. So, and on top of that, the investors are being paid in stock. they're not even getting a lump sum payment. So this is another example of how the market and the setup that we're seeing right now is rewarding speculation. And this is extremely symptomatic of the kinds of conditions we see in the latter stages of a bull market, because it approximates mania. When a company that makes money is taken over by a company that doesn't make money, that's an inconsistency. That's a contradiction. And one of the biggest lessons from crowd psychology is that crowds in a mania accept contradiction as fact. When day traders talk about stocks can only go up, again, obviously, that is obviously a contradiction, but it is taken as fact. And that, I think, is one of the factors that is inhibiting. That's certainly a question here, because we have got the conditions that we could have a bubble. But in order to have the bubble, in order for the price of stock markets to surge on the upside and get to truly, truly extraordinary valuations, we're going to have to see a wall of new money hitting the market. And that could be in the shape of additional spending by governments. It could be by additional rounds of quantitative easing by central banks. But they don't have an incentive to do that unless they see a significant retracement in economic activity. So if that's the case, we need to consider what is it that could create that source of additional liquidity. Well, it could be that the coronavirus flares up again. Some people are talking about it being a second wave, but considering the fact that we're still in the first wave, it's probably simply that the measures to contain it have been ineffectual, and are perhaps, I think more accurately, that they haven't been implemented sufficiently well. One thing, though, that we are seeing, which is, I think, a significant challenge, is the rise of social unrest. Now, I've been talking about the rise of populism for the last few years, and I've often characterized it as a revolt against the status quo. It's both a revolt against the impact of globalization, which robbed a significant portion of the workforce in developed markets and gave their jobs to the emerging markets. That helped to both create deflation because of lower consumer prices, which helped all workers. It enriched the more wealthy people in society, which helped to create this imbalance and inequality that we have now. And today we're starting to see a revolt against it. On top of that, we've had technological innovation, which is inherently deflationary. The continued improvements in connectivity with the rollout of 5G is likely to be an additional deflationary factor. Technology is all about doing more with less. The pinnacle of technological innovation is dematerialization. That's often one of the terms used by Silicon Valley. What dematerialization means is that you take a physical object and through technological innovation, you make that object disappear and yet still fulfill the same functions. The tape recorder, the record player, the bookstore, they've all been dematerialized. But the secondary effect of dematerialization is dehumanization, because you no longer need the people to create the product. You no longer need people to staff the stores. You no longer need people to transport the product. So the number of jobs that do not require highly specialized or technical education continues to shrink. And this is a significant challenge to the world order. When we think about the fact that today we have millions of people unemployed, there is a significant push towards automation. And the way to produce goods and services without human contact. Therefore, that is likely to represent an acceleration of dematerialization and dehumanization, which is going to create masses of people with no jobs. And that's a significant challenge. It's not something that is going to be eradicated simply with the provision of additional liquidity. Well, one thing that could help to get people back to work is infrastructure development, because we need infrastructure to achieve better standards of living. We need more roads for transportation. We need more power plants for electricity. The way that the political sphere is changing with the adoption of green policies is something that is going to create taxation for everything else to fund it. Therefore, we need additional migration away from traditional sources of electricity. That is inevitable. The use of coal has practically collapsed entirely during the quarantine session, while natural gas demand has increased. I strongly believe that the natural gas price gives us an object lesson in Economics 101, because the depressed price of a vital commodity is literally creating demand out of nothing. We are at the dawn of a hydrogen economy because natural gas prices are cheap and because there is a clear demand for an alternative to both coal for natural gas, but also for oil in terms of gasoline demand. So that answer is going to be natural gas, at least in the early stages of the bull market. Eventually, we are going to see additional sources of hydrogen emerge, whether that is going to be technology-led or otherwise, but in the short term, the majority of hydrogen will be reformed from natural gas. This is likely to be a significant investment theme over the course of the next decade, together with the demand for additional infrastructure in terms of roads and bridges and power plants. When we look at copper, it has rebounded really quite impressively, and it is now another instrument that is at a key level. There is a 2.5 year sequence of lower rally highs, but it has bounced emphatically from the lower side of the range that's forming, and it's in the region of the 200-day moving average. We're due consolidation. The big question is, how much consolidation, how deep will it go, and where will support come through, and subsequently, will it rally enough to break the sequence of lower rally highs? Copper is instrumental in all kinds of infrastructure. It is deeply entwined with global economic growth. So there is the clear scope for governments to invest in infrastructure as a direct response to the dehumanization from globalization and from technological innovation. The problem we have today is social unrest. The lockdowns have certainly been worse than they could have been. The countries that implemented them late have had to engage in lockdowns for longer. That was always likely to be the case. There was a very cavalier attitude adopted by some countries, and that they are now paying for that in terms of the size of the economic contraction. But there is no country has 100% got control over the coronavirus, except perhaps for Australia and New Zealand. And even then, they are still under stress from the fall off in demand for exports. The problem with the rise of populism is that it's a lurch to the extremes of the political spectrum. I guess the rallying call of political populism is what about me? Now, the problem that we are likely to face over the coming year is over the last 6 years, what we have primarily been treated to is right-wing populism. Right-wing populism is a form of libertarianism. It is about cutting taxes, giving people more choices, reducing regulation, championing nationalism, and attempting to trade on a mercantilist basis to champion the domestic economy. And it is generally, I think, rewarded by investors because lower taxes help corporate profitability. And if we look at how it has worked, Narendra Modi was the first of the populist leaders, and the stock market reacted well to his initial election back in 2014. Now, subsequently, India has pulled back because of the difficulty of dealing with the coronavirus in a highly densely populated country with an underdeveloped medical system. But it is quite likely that India will be a beneficiary once this crisis ends. When we look at the Philippines, Rodrigo Duterte got into power on the back of a law and order mandate, and he has gone through an extraordinarily aggressive campaign of dealing with drug dealers, and that has extended to extrajudicial killings. But the stock market generally has supported him. Nonetheless, the market was not immune from the pullback. The Brazilian market has also been pulling back of late because of the coronavirus, but it surged in the immediate aftermath of Bolsonaro winning. Now, the only country that has, in fact, elected a left-wing populist is Mexico. But the issue with taking Mexico as an example is that the coalition that he had to put together was heavily dependent on parties from all parts of the political spectrum. So he has not been able to deploy a full left-wing populist agenda. But the populist agenda, from a left-wing perspective, is aimed at higher taxes, nationalization of private assets, the potential for censorship to clamp down on any kind of opposition, and the clear potential for socialism to really take hold, where there is wealth taxes and redistribution. Now, those are factors that are going to become progressively more relevant as we monitor the complexion of the protest movements that are emerging today on the streets of major countries around the world. The Antifa and Black Lives Matter movement that has overtaken cities all over the USA can only be described as a left-wing populist movement. They're talking about redistribution. There has been a significant effort to censor any and all opposition. Anyone who utters even a semblance of opposition is labeled as a racist. There have been significant firings by a number of different newspapers. That alone is a significant issue. When we think about what the factors are that contribute to improving governance, the first is respect for minority shareholder interests. And when those are threatened, you need an independent judiciary so that you can take whoever is trying to take your shares off you and take them to court. You also need a free press so that the abuses in a system can be more publicly aired. Now, the problem with anyone who voices any kind, even a modicum of opposition to a popular movement being fired and censored, is that it removes the efficacy of a free press, because a press corps is no longer free if they cannot write what they want. Now, that's a significant issue for the USA. It's a significant issue for the UK and for other countries when left-wing populists start to take over. That is something that could have a material effect on the stock market. And quite apart from the response that we've had to the Federal Reserve this week, that is a trend which I believe is essential to monitor, because the rise of left-wing populism is not only something that is alien to capitalism, but it is also representative of the fact that the people who pioneered right-wing populism have generally tended to be older. And when the younger generation is in opposition to the older generation, then they necessarily are going to support the opposite spectrum, which is, in this case, left-wing populism. So it can also be framed in terms of a generation war, because there is no denying that wealth and privilege and pensions are concentrated among the older generations, and poverty, lack of opportunity, and debts are concentrated among the younger generations, who are in turn expected to work in order to fund the pensions of the older generations. This is obviously going to create an area of stress, and the younger crowd will always win, and not least because the older generation will eventually die off and lose their electoral advantage. Now, that is a trend that is undeniable. The only potential way it could be averted would be to, in some way, shape, or form, to subvert the populist movement from the left wing. And at the moment, there doesn't seem to be a clear vision for that. One thing that we can certainly say is that iconoclastic movements, destruction of Palmyra by ISIS, the standing Buddhas by the Taliban, and the defacing of the statue of Churchill, for example, in the UK, the pulling down of monuments in the USA, that is to rewrite history, to paint everyone who came before as a villain. The reality of the human experience is that none of us are 100% good or 100% bad. There is, every one of us is a sinner at some point in our lives. The fact that Churchill is not fondly remembered in India is very fondly remembered in the UK for being one of the most instrumental figures in success in the Second World War. Well, these are facts. The fact that Cromwell was championed in the UK for pioneering Parliament but vilified in Ireland for his statement to Hell or to Connacht. Well, again, these are factors that there is no person is all good or all bad, and that no country is all good or all bad, that every country has got something in their history that is shaming to them. The unwillingness to talk about the failings of the past, the lessons learned, and the good things done by people in the past is also reflective of the crowd at an extreme, because crowds are sharply discriminatory. And if you're not with us, you're against us, is the clearest definition of how a crowd in a strong position acts. Well, on the one hand, therefore, we have this evolving mania in the stock market, but we also have an evolving mania on Main Street, and their interests, or the interests of those two groups, is not mutually aligned. This represents the biggest threat that we have right now. This revolt on the streets, and its very clear socialist, communist, and redistributionist origins is an existential threat to the secular bull market. And the fact that the gold price has been outperforming stocks over the course of the last 2.5 years is something that we do need to pay attention to, because this still looks like a consistent trend. So we can then think about, well, where are we in the overall environment? The first is that we're at a critical juncture. The market could go either way. My fear is that if we do pop on the upside here and we get a further acceleration of asset prices, it is going to further exacerbate the problem on Main Street. If President Trump wins the election, then there's going to be civil unrest. So that is also something that could have a deleterious effect on prices at the end of the year. When we think about what could ameliorate the situation, then a vaccine being produced. There are three vaccines that are quickly entering phase 3 trials over the next few months. That is a further example of how technological innovation streamlines the process of innovation just by itself, that acceleration foments acceleration. Then we have the potential that with a vaccine, the whole long process of dealing with this natural disaster will come to a close. Of course, then the debts are going to have to be repaid, and then central banks will be less willing to provide additional assistance. So one way or the other, we are in the latter stages of this bull market. It is really only a question of how long it can be extended. So I think that's one of the most important aspects. Then we have the potential that it could end sooner, that the challenges that are evolving today and the unwillingness of central banks to in fact inflate a bubble will contribute to additional downside. And then, of course, we have the fact that there is a wall of debt that is now outstanding, and that the logical inconsistencies that are emerging in the market are really quite extreme. That suggests to me, at least, that it is time that we need to be more cautious, that there are obviously significant challenges and there are a lot of uncertainties out there. And if that is the case, then smaller positions make sense. And I think with that, I will leave you for the weekend, and I wish all the best to all of you.